Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 31st, 2006, and today's session is entitled Roots Survive, presented by Shelley Moore Guy, number GUS 2006-01. Let's listen in.
It's a wonderful thing to have drums, because drums are our heartbeat. And I noticed that whenever there's drumming in the room, I think people respond. Don't you think they respond? Didn't you respond? I mean, it feels like someone's talking to you. Yesterday when the drummers were on the thing out there waiting for the people to leave, or drumming the people away, Dorian, my friend, said, "I got to go find the drums," because we were up there somewhere. And she says, "I got to go find the drums, because we have to go find the heartbeat, the rhythm, and that's who we are." My name is Shelley Moore Guy. I am a storyteller, griot, and that's G-R-I-O-T, African griot. Griot is a person who knows all the stories in the village, tells the stories to the children, knows the history of the tribes. The griot is the person who can help the parents, help the children become the people that they are supposed to be. And that's a large responsibility, isn't it? The first time I said I'm a griot, I thought someone in the audience was going to say, "No, you're not." But the wonderful thing about, you know, living and life is that you get to name yourself. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Naming ourselves, naming our children. And how do we do that? You know, we do that because we do that through our families. Our neighborhoods can add to that. And everything in the village. So when we talk about villages, you know, that proverb that became a cliche, and it takes a village to raise a child. And it's true, it became a cliche because, you know, people were throwing it around here and there and everywhere. And I think Hillary Clinton wrote a book. And, you know, and we Americans grow weary of phrases very quickly, without getting to the definition and the meaning of such. So it takes a village to raise a child, and it means that it takes all of us and everyone in this village, every sub-village within the larger village, you know, that would be our schools and our churches, our grocery stores, all of those systems, that framework that help build children. So that's what we're going to talk about today. I'm going to share some stories and some poetry. I'm going to ask you to help me tell the stories, because storytellers understand that we can't tell the story without you. We need you to help us tell the story. As a matter of fact, I'm told that in Haiti, the storytellers are just as famous as our Michael Jordan, and you know, and that's kind of that's getting old, isn't it? Who are we talking about now? We're talking about LeBron James, or but you understand the Michael Jordan, our Michael Jordan is very, very famous. I mean, when we think that we're able, we will go and see him. You know, we pay attention to what he says. Some of us pay attention to what he says. We liked what he did. Our most famous movie stars, actresses, and you know, all of those people are very famous, and so are storytellers in Haiti. As a matter of fact, when the people know that a particular storyteller is coming to town, the people get ready. And how do they get ready? Well, they gather their children. Whatever they need, their blankets, whatever it is that they need, they gather themselves to go to that place. And when that storyteller arrives, well, the ovation is like you would never believe. So I came into Holden Village, storyteller that I am, and when people found out that I am a storyteller, that I dared to name myself a storyteller, they responded. You know, they didn't clap on the spot, but I felt that warmth. I felt that acceptance, because all of us love a good story. We began with stories. And so in Haiti, when the storyteller arrives and stands on the spot and decides it's time to tell the story. He or she asks the audience, "May I tell my story?" And storyteller asks that question by using one word. It's a question. And the question is creek. And in that one word, that one question, the storyteller asks permission to tell the story and also promises to tell a good story. And if you, the audience, wants the storyteller to continue, you respond by saying crack. Now, in saying crack, you are telling the storyteller, yes, you may tell your story. So creek?
Crack.
Creek?
Crack.
Now, the other part of that agreement that you made is that you're telling me, yes, you may tell your story. We expect that you'll tell some good stories. You know, you better tell some good stories. And you have agreed to become part of the story. You will participate. Okay? Now, I'm going to start with a story. And I'm going to need some doom-dockers, some swish-washers, and some click-clappers. Creek!
Crack!
Doom-dockers. Swish-washers. Just come on. Swish-washers, click-clappers. I mean, we need more than one in each group.
Oh, good.
Everybody has to know again. I said some. We need some doom-dockers, some swish-washers, and some click-clappers. We're going to face the audience. That audience. All right. All right, let's move on.
We have too many.
Okay. Doom-dockers. Swish-washers.
How to swish that feeling, man.
All right, and click clappers. I think they can handle that. Okay, now, here's you, doom-dockers. Doom-dock, doom-dock-dock, doom-dock, doom-dock-dock, doom-dock, doom-dock-dock, doom-dock, doom-dock. Very good, very good. Very good. Swish-washers. Swish, swash, bip, bap, bap, swish, swash, bip, bap, bap, swish, swash, bip, bap, bap, swish, swash, bip, bap, bap. Clip clappers, ready?
Get together in your pockets.
Clip clap, clip clap, clip clap, 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 clip clap, clip clap, clip clap, clap, clap. Very good. Drummers, you can help. Anytime. Okay, now, this story is important. Not just because I wrote it myself, but because I think it helps us remember our responsibility to the children in the community. Okay? This story is called How Little Billy Learned to Play. Little Billy, this story is based loosely, sort of, kind of, on the life of a friend of mine, Bill Bell. Bill Bell is a pianist, jazz pianist. They call him the jazz professor. The very wonderful thing about Bill Bell is that Bill was born and raised where I come from, the Quad Cities, in a place they call Watertown, East Moline. East Moline is the city, and there's a little community, a little village within East Moline called Watertown. And within Watertown, I'm not saying that it was predominantly black, but a lot of the people there were black. It was kind of multicultural, but there was a lot of black people that moved from south to the Midwest to find jobs at John Deere and the other places that, where they could find work. And Bill's family was part of that tradition of Watertowners. And there are some very proud Watertowners still in East Moline. They don't talk about Watertown as much as they refer to it because, you know, people started moving out, they spread out. But when you say, When I say that Bill Bell is from East Moline, and I don't say Watertown, somebody in the audience will say, he's from Watertown, because they're proud of the fact they come from Watertown, and that Bill is one of theirs. Bill Bell is 70 years old, grew up in Watertown, East Moline, went to school there, attended church there, went to college at Augustana, Augustana alumni, went to the University of Iowa, I think, and taught around in our area for a while, and then ultimately ended up teaching at a college in California where he lives today. And Bill comes home whenever he can to share his music because he believes that jazz music is good for the family, is good for the children there. He says that there's a democracy contained in jazz that that we can learn from and teach our kids about. Plus, he just wants kids to understand that they can be musicians, that if he could become Bill Bell, jazz professor, that they can become who they need to be as well. So, in talking to Bill, I found out that his mother, his uncle, and all of the people in the community helped him become who he became. And, you know, he's very proud of that. So I wrote this story. I had this vision of this little boy learning how to play the piano. And that his uncle was there, his mother was there, the people from the neighborhood, they were all there cheering him on from day one, you know. And then I took poetic justice and I put my own uncle in there, my Uncle Ferdinand. My Uncle Ferdinand couldn't play an instrument, but I'm telling you, he could make these sounds. He would stand in the middle of the floor and hold his arms and his hands like they were instruments of any kind, and he would make these incredible sounds. And that is largely what I learned my rhythm. He would also pound on tables very rhythmically. And so he taught me how to do that. So this is a story about how little Billy became the jazz professor. Pardon my cough. Is everybody ready?
We're ready.
Do,
do,
da,
do,
da, da,
stoosh, stosh. Do da da do da 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 do da da do.
Little Billy's Uncle Ferdinand used to play music with his hands. It's true. He pounded on the tables with his knuckles and the base of his hands, making a musical beat that sounded like this.
Do da do da da.
He'd slap his legs in his chest.
Do da da. Swish swash. Big bang bang.
Then he clapped his hands. Tried to do it too, but he would place his little six-year-old hands on the tables and he would pound and pound. But he always ended up beating the table and slapping his chest and his legs in an offbeat way. Uncle Ferdinand would laugh, but he just kept right on beating the table.
Do da, do da, da.
And slapping his chest.
Do da, da. Swish, swash.
Little Billy loved him some Uncle sounds his hands could make. Every once in a while, he'd climb up on Uncle Ferdinand's lap and he'd say, "Uncle Ferdinand, who taught you how to play your hands?" Well, Uncle always said that the people from Africa played their hands before there was any such thing as a drum or a piano. Said that his great-great-grandfather had come from Africa and taught his great-grandfather, who taught his father, and taught him. He told Little Billy that the beat is in his blood, and he asked Little Billy to always remember that. Little Billy always said that when he grew bigger, he was going to play his hands too. Uncle Ferdinand said that if he learned to play real good, that he would buy Little Billy a small piano or a small drum. So Little Billy practiced playing his hands anytime and any place. Sometimes his mother and father would say, "Little Billy, stop keeping up all that racket." But it just seemed like he had to play. Little Billy even played his hands in his sleeves. Sleep. Swish. Swash. Bam. 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 Swish. Swash. Bam. 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 By the time he was 8 years old, Little Billy, he could keep a real good beat. When he was 9, his parents began to ask Little Billy to play his hands when company came to visit. Everybody in the neighborhood knew about Little Billy and his musical hands because he found a board that he carried around with him everywhere he went. He took that board to church and played along when the choir sang. He took that board with him to the riverbank and played when he was trying to catch a fish. He even took that board to school and practiced during recess. Sometimes Little Billy would sit on his front steps and play, and Mr. Williams from next door would come over and play his harmonica. Miss Esther would come over from across the street and sing, "My baby, sweet baby." Why, who knew Miss Esther could scat like that? Like that. Swah, wah, wah, wee, shoo, wee, wee. With the people from the neighborhood clapping and dancing, Little Billy, Mr. Williams, and Miss Esther jamming. Why? It was like a concert on 11th Street where they lived. Do da, do da da, switch, swash, beat, bat bat, switch, swash, beat, da da, switch, swash, beat, da da, switch, swash, beat, da da, switch, da da, do da da. On the day Little Billy turned 10 years old, Uncle Ferdinand came to visit. He put a record on the record player and he said, "Let's hear some blues, Billy. Let's hear some jazz." And he started playing his hands. And this time, Little Billy joined in. They made their music all night long until it was time for Little Billy to go to bed, where he dreamed of music in Africa. He dreamed of lots and lots of people sitting around playing music. When he woke up the next morning, he found in his room a small piano and a small set of drums. And there was a note from Uncle Ferdinand. It said, "Here are the drums and the piano I promised you. I know you'll learn to play them well. But play your hands every now and then, Little Billy, and don't forget where the rhythm starts." Little Billy grew up and became a fine musician, playing with famous jazz and blues men from all over the world. He became a man who taught music to his children, and he taught music to anyone else who wanted to learn. Whenever he sees the people from the old neighborhood these days, they say, "Little Billy, are you still playing your hands?" And they laugh because they know where it all started. Sometimes Mr. Williams and Mr. Esther and Little Billy, well, they jam just the way they used to. Now when he wants to create a song these days, Little Billy plays his hands, remembering the stories about his family and the stories about Africa. He thinks of his Uncle Ferdinand smiling down on him, giving him energy, and he knows that the beat is in his blood. I said the beat is in his blood.
Do da, do da da, do da, do da da, do da, do da da, do da. Do, 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 do
Thank you very much. How Little Billy Learned to Play. It's one of my favorite stories, and it just knocks me out that I wrote it. Well, I come from a town in the Midwest, Rock Island, Illinois, and you guys have probably heard about Rock Island, and you know, maybe you've been to the Quad Cities, but you know, we have all these people in Holden Village who are connected to Holden Village and Rock Island, Augustana College and all of that. And I grew up around people who just really cared about me. Just, you know, there was never a question. They weren't perfect people, but they cared about Shelley. And I knew that, even around all their imperfections. I knew that I was cared for, and there were all of these people, these cousins and these aunts and these uncles and grandparents who were there to remind me who I am. Now, I would stray some, but always in the back of my mind, even when I was out there straying, always in the back of my mind, you know, there was that voice or several voices. And no matter how long it took, those voices and those lessons would bring me back home. They would just bring me back home. Now, when I met Bill Bell for the first time, it was because he came home to present a concert, which, like I said, he does periodically. And they asked me, the presenters of this concert, asked me to please write a form that I could recite during the, at the beginning of the concert. And I said I would, but I could not shake the memory or the vision of this little kid, this little Billy, first learning to play. So they called on the night of the performance. They called that morning. And the performance was going to be that night. And they said, are you got the poem? And I said, well, I had a vision of a story, and I wrote a story. And they said, well, you know, we want a poem. So I had like 6 hours. And I sat down. I just swallowed my gum. And it was essential. I sat down and I thought, what would I write if I were Bill? And I had left home, and the idea, what is it like to leave home for a long time? You know, to make your home someplace else. And come home, you know, to visit periodically as much as you can. But what is it like to come home to visit? Because you're not only going to be visiting the town, you're going to be visiting people. And what did those people represent? How would it feel if you were to sit down and write something, you know, that you wanted people to understand about how you felt about where you're from? You ever think about that? How many of you don't live in the place where you were raised? Just about everybody. So what would you write if someone had, you know, and I thought the first thing I would do is I would sit down and I would think about the sights. Those sights, those things that I remember, you know, of course, and the people, after the people, and I would think the smells, the sounds, you know, the things that made me feel good about my life. And then I would think about the lessons, you know, and what is it I get to do when I get there? You know, that I can't do, I can go anywhere in the world, but I could never do what I can do when I get home. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense to those of you who go home? So I wrote this poem called Coming Home. In our lives, there comes a time and a space when we know where we come from. When the words and the rhythm come together, the signs and the sounds merge, and we become one with our roots, acknowledging the people whose backs served as bridges, whose dreams and aspirations fed us, whose courageous acts of faith guided us, even away from the village, away from the place we call home. We take with us tender lessons that bring us back. They always bring us back home. Home. It's where the body comes to rest. It's where our eyes can behold the place where love sustains us. It's where we come to talk that talk around those who understand we know we belong. Home is the place that got us over. And when we arrive, we realize that our mission is to reach back, reach over, reach around, and reach through to embrace one another. We can save one another when survival means more than just breathing. It is solidarity. The African proverb states, I am because you are, and because you are, therefore, I am. And when we reach that space and we know that, there is a rejoicing in the spirit because we've made the trip. Drummers, please. It takes a village. This is a poem that I wrote in like 1994 or 95. It was 89, 90. It was during a time when my oldest son was about to go to college, and I couldn't hardly stand it. Mm-hmm. I just, what in the world, where'd the time go? Where did the time go? I was a very young mother. I was a teenage mother. I had all of my children, and I had five before I was 21. That's what my mother said. Oh, man. Oh. And I understand that, oh, it gets you right here. What? If you've had children, you know, oh. But I survived it. And I survived it largely because of those people in that village, because when you're a teenage mother, or when you have five children before you're 21, there are things that you just can't know. You just can't know. You may want to know them, but at 20, 21, you can't know certain things about life. And so therefore, there has to be people, there has to be those people who will stand in what we call the gap, because there are many gaps when you are 21 and you have five. There are gaps all day. All day there are gaps. Sometimes you have to fill them in yourself. You wing it. You do what you have to do. But, my children would not be the children, the people they are, had someone not been a lot of someone's, hadn't come into the house and said, move out of the way, let me do it. Let me show you how. You're not doing it right. Because that's just the way that it goes. Now, that was in the 70s. It's happening. It's still happening now, isn't it? Sure. It's happening now. I'll be 52 in September, and you can forget. Years of life will help you forget where you've been. And I can sit around people, and I can see people. I can see young girls walking up and down the street with babies. And oh my gosh, somebody inevitably will say, oh my God, look at her. She's got how many kids? How old is she? And I'll snap back because that was me. And it's horrifying to think that I was that young. Did I look that young? Oh my God, they must have prayed for me all day. Every day they had to. How do you account for someone being able to survive that and raise children and stand before any crowd? So, was it because Shelley was so much more special than other teenage parents? No. It was largely because grace, of course, in the form of people who came to help, you know, who were just there. Even when they chastised me, they loved me, and they were there. Was I different, special? Only in my unique sort of way. Was I more worthy than any other teenage mother that you see today? Not in your life. Not in your life. Was I lucky? No. I had good fortune to have people in my life. There's no such thing as that luck thing. People are there or they're not. They're just not. We're helping to raise the children who are raising children, or we're not. There's no other way around it, is there? No other way around it. No other way around it. Well, going back to my childhood and those things that sustain us, those sights and sounds and people, there is something that I wrote just to hold on to that. When I started writing poetry, I was in my 20s. I was probably 24. I wasn't one of those kids who grew up knowing that she was going to be a poet. I lived with a poet. My brother, who is 6 years older than I am, Michael, was the first poet that I met. And Michael was, we just thought, you know, when you're 10 and your older brother is 16, that's a big old difference, isn't it? You know, but when you're both in your 20s, the bridge kind of closes. But when you're 10 and you have a 16-year-old brother who is in high school, that's huge. And so he was writing this poetry, and of course, my 10-year-old self didn't understand it. And the poetry that we were reading in school, you know, through the years, you know, did we understand that? You know, no, I didn't. So I decided that poetry or poets are people who are so intelligent and writing such profound things that you're not supposed to understand it. You know, you're just supposed to be, and that was not me. Until I read some poetry by Maya Angelou and Nikki Giovanni, and I wrote, read these pieces in the late 70s, and these were, some of them were old pieces, some were new, and I began to see myself writing poetry that people could understand because I understood these women. And if they were writing things that you were supposed to, they want you to understand, you know. And then I began to write just because it healed me. You know, I could take a subject and it would just make me feel so good that these are my words. And then, of course, I would call my friends and my family, and I would bug them, you know, and they love to hear it until, you know, after a while it gets old, and they say, I'll call you back. Call me later, I'll call you, you know. But it's just, I got fed. And so I was in my 20s, and I began to write about my childhood experiences. This, though, I did write when my son was getting ready to go to college, and it's really about a day in the life, a summer day in my life, any summer day in my life. We took sunshine showers during the summers in my neighborhood, skipping and jumping, twirling round and round until we dropped and hugged ourselves, getting lost in all that laughter and carefree day tripping, feeling lucky to be alive in a place where everyone knew our names. The ice cream man peddled his product from a bicycle with a freezer in the front. We bought popsicles to cool us down if we had the nickels, sucking and savoring until the drops of colored sugar ran down between our fingers, remember that? Mingling with the dirt there, and we licked that too. The rag man pushed an old cart slowly through the street, calling for scraps of cloth. And though we mocked him secretly, he was a major player, an entrepreneur known by our parents who would wave and call him by name as they stood behind the screen door or worked from the clothesline. Old Mrs. Robinson stood spying from her window, ready to check us when we dared to climb her tree or run through her yard, but she forgave us and often shared ice water, cookies, and stories of herself as a young woman. She was still in love with her husband who had passed. We ran errands for her and shared our precious moments when her loneliness slowed us down every now and then. We chased grasshoppers as a ritual, stacked them in jars and punched holes in the lids so they could live until we placed them in garbage cans and fried them. The tobacco juice they left amazed us. At night, lightning bugs supplied homemade rings for our fingers, full of dust now and ready for a bath. We sold popcorn and Kool-Aid for pennies, played hand games, Red Rover, kickball, baseball, hide and go seek. We practiced the latest dance steps as we sang the latest songs, and we took sunshine showers all day beneath the familiar eyes of our sky, surrounded by love in a place where everyone knew our names. Anybody remember anything about a rag man? Really?
I heard one thing you may not know, that you started out as a rag man in Minneapolis, and it became Rag Sock, which now sells vintage clothing. And they're they have two or three branches, and people shop there, and their stuff is no longer cheap. So there's a rag man.
So they started off as a rag man.
Yeah.
Get out of here. I grew up in a place, I grew up in a place in Rock Island called, we just call it the Projects. It was low-income housing. And Rock Island right now, I think the population is like 48,000. It's the population has decreased. But back in the days when as I said, people started migrating to Rock Island, they came because of industry, John Deere and what else, International Harvester and Caterpillar and all those places. And these places would advertise down south, you know, and because they wanted to recruit people and they wanted to recruit black folks. And so that's how there was this migration happened. And my folks actually were from Rock Island. But now how do we get there? By way of great-great-grandparents who were slaves in Kentucky. And my grandfather, his name was Charlie Wilson, he joined the Civil War. And the last thing that he did for the war, as a soldier, was he guarded prisoners at the Rock Island Arsenal, which was called it was a prison at the time. And so that's how that part of the family, that side, moved to Rock Island. And so his daughter met my great grandfather, who was working from Boston, worked on the river, and made it up some kind of way on the Mississippi River to Port Byron, Illinois, where they, that family, my grandfather and his family, settled and met, and he was a Moore, his name was Moore, and he met my great-grandmother. They got married and settled in Rock Island, so that's how that happened. So we've been in Rock Island for a long time. My parents moved into the Projects, and we just called it the Projects. Our parents knew that there was probably a stigma, but in the 50s when they built it, I don't think that they were feeling that way. I think it was a good place to be. I'm not saying that there were any single parent homes. There were several, but it was just so natural to see fathers and mothers raising children, and a lot of these guys were veterans. Early 50s. They felt that this was a, they were going to get a piece of the pie. And raising their children in this new, clean environment was one of the things that they were going to do and save money to eventually move someplace else, which they actually did. So it was a different time. I was born in 1954. And they moved in when my mother was pregnant with me. So by the time I was 6 or 7 years old, I was still there. I didn't move out of there until I was 9 years old. But it was a good place to be. Now, I'm sure over the years my parents felt a stigma, but we didn't feel it. And I was just so grateful because they did not, they allowed us to be children. The burden was not ours to raise ourselves, they raised us. and they raised us in this cool environment. And we just felt that this poem was written, you know, It Takes a Village, was written because I loved my life. You know, that one summer day, those summer days, they were awesome. And now, you know, later on, you know, when I moved my children to low-income projects, they were still calling projects at the time, there was a stigma. I understood as a parent what it was like, but it was still better than not having a place to live. What I found out is, as much as I didn't want to be there with my children, they felt like I did about my projects. And I felt like I did something right. I raised my children to be children. They remain children until it was time for them not to be children. But they carry great memories, and that was, you know, what else can you say as a parent? You know, even amid all the mess, that you raise kids who like their life, you know, and wanted to, you know, and want to tell people about it. So hopefully they will. There's a poem that I wrote after I moved my children out of the projects, because we moved into a place in Davenport, Iowa, which is across the bridge. It's a, you know, the Mississippi separates us, and you just go right across the bridge and go to Iowa. You know, the bridge is like a street to us, you know. You get on the bridge, you know, Centennial Street, or the Arsenal Bridge, and you go to Davenport. And so I moved them over there, way in northwest Davenport, and I call it suburbia. So we went from the Arsenal Courts, which is a project, you know, right? The majority of the people who lived there were black, and we moved all the way to suburbia in northwest Davenport. And I had reached a point in my life where I just thought, you know what, I can live anywhere that I want. I had become a tenant organizer, and so I was this activist. And so, you know, I got to carry all of my anger and all of that with me. And I can live anywhere I want to. I can live anywhere I want to. And we moved over to northwest Davenport, and culture shock set in for everybody and all of us at the same time. All of us, all the kids and me, even the cousins, the little cousins who visited, we all felt it, and it happened at the same time. You know, I'd say within a month, oh my God, me as a parent, what have I done? You know, and my daughters, I have twin daughters, and one of them woke up one morning and told me that she heard black voices outside the window. Voices of her friends and neighbors and where she came from. And she was probably in second grade. And it was just amazing, because that morning I thought I heard it too. And she came, you know, she came into my bedroom, she said, Mama, I heard people, I heard black people outside. And I, you know, I said, I do, they're not there. But anyway, this is where we're at. And this is how it is. And, you know, and life continues, and it goes on and on and on. And new experiences are what we're made for. And so I wrote this poem on that day. The children say, oh, and one other thing. In our neighborhood growing up, there was this thing about climbing the hill. You know, the West End is below the hill. That's where we were, where I grew up at. It was below the hill, and you could only go to a certain, you know, when I was growing up, black people could only move to a certain level in terms of the neighborhood. And so, but you always heard, because, you know, the park, Longview Park, but we had parks below there, but they always talked about on top of the hill. We were below the hill, and there were people on top of the hill, you know, and on top of the hill is where you wanted to get, you know, even if, when we finally did move, we didn't move on top of the hill, but we were close enough to it, you know, when they finally allowed a few blacks to break that barrier. I was in fifth grade, and my parents moved us into this place, and, you know, it was just wonderful. The Longview Park was two blocks down the street, and, you know, all of these things were just wonderful, but I remember culture shock, it set in. So this poem is called Climbing the Hill. My children say they awaken some mornings to the familiar sounds of black voices outside their bedroom window. Instead, they look to find the faces of our neighbors who are white or no faces at all. We've moved from the projects in search of a better life. I said the project's walls were closing in. I imagined I'd die there, and if I did, so would the children. But today, I remember the day I moved from my projects as a child, those baseball games on the sidewalk, relay races in the street, pop bottles sold to Minnie at her market, rags sold to Reuben at his junkyard, movies at the Rialto Theater, renamed the rat hole, but I never saw a rat. I saw Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte there, and Mom always gave us toilet paper just in case. We'd stroll down 9th Street without permission, checking out the sights to the sounds of, "Hey, ain't you Vance's kids? And you kids better get out of that street before I tell your mama." Familiar sounds. When it was time to move in, we adjusted well, as most children do, taught the new neighborhood whites our project games, went swimming at the pool down the street, and Mom had a garden in her very own yard, the American dream, until the newness faded and we wanted to move back to what was familiar. So yes, I know how my children feel when they say they miss their neighborhood, their relay races in the street, kickball games on the grass, pop bottles sold at the corner store to the sounds of, "Hey, ain't you Shelly's kids? And you kids better get out of that street before I tell your mama." Familiar sounds. And I wonder if they'll find another way to climb that awesome hill. Climbing the hill. How much time do I have?
Plenty of time.
Plenty of time. Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna end on time, but I'm gonna end with the story of Charlie Wilson. We were fortunate in that one of our local historians, John Halberg, and his, you know, he was just this fabulous historian from our area, and you know, just always trying to get with people and get their stories, and he found my great-great-grandfather. He found him in Port Byron, Illinois. Port Byron is a river town, and they were able to move there, Charlie and his wife, my grandmother Eliza, because there was work for Charlie there. And this was after the war and all of that. They lived in Rock Island for 10 years and then moved on to Port Byron. Only black family in the town, but you know, it was about making a living. And he was what they called an old settler. And John Halberg went around in 1914, around there, finding all the old settlers, and Charlie was one of these guys. And we came to find out that there's all this information about our great-great-grandfather at the Rock Island Historical Society. Among John Halberg's papers, we never even knew it. One of my friends who was an editor, a writer, was putting together something, and she asked me about my people, and she knew. My great uncle is Tim Moore, who was an actor in vaudeville and different things, and he was Kingfish in the Amos and Andy series and things like that. So she knew that, and so since she knew that, she knew, because she'd edited this history book about Rock Island. So here is Charlie Wilson's story in his own words. And it reads like a slave narrative. I don't know if any of you are familiar with slave narratives. Slave narratives start with, it's very simple. This is where I was, this is how it affected me, this is how I got out, you know, and this is who I am today. John Halberg left his words intact. And a lot of the slave narratives are reinterpreted. But this is Charlie Wilson, Horse Doctor. Interview with John Halberg, November 4th, 1914. I ain't got no story to tell. I don't know nothing about this country. I'm an old settler in one way, and in another, I ain't. I was born and raised in Kentucky. I was on a plantation in Barron County, Glasgow, and I changed hands from one to another. I was a slave in Kentucky. I found when I was a boy I belonged to my mother, and she belonged to the Starks family. They had 5 girls. The one I belonged to married a man by the name of Wilson. The old boss who owned me was in the racehorse business. I was a rider until I got too big. I was through Kentucky and Tennessee on races, and after that I was a hostler, and then he put me to work at the shoemaker's trade. I made shoes for the family and neighbors and took care of the horses. And after I got through racing, I married and we lived on the plantation. I stayed with my old boss until 1864. I left home on the 4th of July. Lincoln hadn't freed the slaves at that time. We just pulled out and went anyway. Our bosses were bitter against us going to war. The Yankees put guards at all the railroad stations to keep the rebels from getting us back until we could get to headquarters. Well, I'll tell you, it was funny. In one case, we laid at the depot, and the guard was there to keep the Johnnies from taking us. A fellow named Gatewood had a man there, had a slave there, and he came after him. He said he was going to take his slave back home with him. The guard popped a bayonet into his thigh and pushed him off the platform, and that scared the balance of the rebels away, and we didn't have no more trouble. They all left. We had made up our minds amongst us to go, so we'd go together, 36 of us, 7 from our farm. We'd sneak out at night and get together. Of course, they had men watching so we wouldn't get together and get to plotting, so we had to sneak off into the woods and meet together. My wife stayed till we came to Rock Island to guard prisoners. You see, when a slave enlisted, that freed his wife. Our old boss was pretty fair and told her that she was free to go anytime she wanted to. Company E, 108th U.S. Volunteers is what I belong to. All colored troops went as U.S. volunteers. They didn't go by states like the whites. We had Captain Tuttle. From lieutenant up was white, but corporals and sergeants were of our own people. I was a corporal in Company E. My boss, William Martin Wilson, had about 60 slaves. Only 7 out of the family went. Mr. Wilson owned about 900 acres. Tobacco was the main thing. But he was a livestock dealer. He had blooded racehorses, different breeds, fine cattle, fine sheep. He was going pretty good and was in the state senate when the war broke out. Another thing I want to say is that he was kind to his slaves, gave them good houses, good clothes, and plenty to eat. Not all of them was good to their slaves, but he was. He had stallions, and I looked after them. He was a good horse doctor, and the trainer was a horse doctor, and I learned to doctor horses. When a neighbor's horse got sick, he came in my place while I went over to doctor his horse. The more I did, the more I studied and learned. I made up my mind when I was a boy that I wanted to be a horse doctor. They would have a slave learn most everything, blacksmithing, carpentering, shoemaking, everything was done by hand, no machines in those days. When I was a little fellow, they called me Charlie Washington. You know, that was a long time ago, and George Washington was all the gold then. I was born in 1836. I don't know the date exactly, but my mother remembered it was January. Sometimes they wrote our ages in their Bibles, but when we left, they wouldn't accommodate us that much to tell us. Wilson's house burned afterwards, and they saved nothing from it. The Bible was burned too. My brother, Sandy Terry, belonged to one of the other girls who married a Baptist preacher by the name of Terry. He baptized all the slaves that would come, and what do you suppose he done when we was going to join the war? Well, he said that he was going to take all their names off of the Bible, and there wouldn't be any salvation for them. By jinks, that was a foolish idea. What harm would that do them? I'd know better than that. He thought if we'd take our names off, we'd be lost. My sister belonged to the same man I did. She came with us and got married in Rock Island after the war. Married a man by the name of Morrison. While I was riding horses, I got acquainted with all the big men in Kentucky and Tennessee. Bob Garvin came to the train station when we were leaving to go to war. He came to the window and said to me, "Well, Charlie, so you're going to war. I didn't think you'd leave, old Mr. Wilson." I said, "This is a new deal, Mr. Garvin. This is different. You know, when you turn your canary out of his cage, he don't come back. He's free." Tears came to his eyes, and he said, "Well, Charlie, I hope you good luck. I'd been a prisoner all my life, and this was a new deal. My, we thought a lot of being free." When the war was over, our old master gave us a big dinner after we mustered out. He said, "The land is still here if we want to stay. But my wife was in Rock Island, and so I came here too." I was mustered out in the spring of 1866 and lived at Rock Island until 1876. Al Lyford's father had this lime kiln, and his wife, Mrs. Lyford, wanted my wife to come up and show her how to keep house. She was young, like, you know. My wife, during that time I was in the war, worked for Mrs. Lyford, and that's the way we came to Port Byron. I think. And it was after I discovered this story, you know, how sometimes we think that there's no purpose You know, we just kind of were hatched. You know, we were born, and we take for granted how we were made and all of the many blessings and the people that came, because life gets hard. And it's real easy to lose sight and to lose track of whose we are and who we are. And I remember the story when I can, because, you know, Charlie and Eliza, they couldn't have named me, but they did name. They knew that if they survived, that there would be someone like me. And that, when we think about our lives in those terms, and not just, and you don't have to survive slavery to understand that. We all come from somebody, some people who did something very wonderful because you're still here. You know, and we need to always remember that. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.